This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. I want you to take your research to the next level with Interactive Brokers' redesigned Fundamentals Explorer. Fundamentals Explorer provides comprehensive and worldwide fundamentals data to all IBKR clients at no cost. More than 30,000 companies are covered worldwide with more than 300 data points per company and over 80 sources for news wires and reports. The Fundamentals Explorer lets you dive deep into hundreds of data points covering historical trends, industry comparisons, key ratios, forecast ratings, ownership, and more, so you can see the whole picture. It also now includes a securities lending dashboard that provides complimentary and premium security lending analytics. Use daily short sale data on thousands of securities worldwide to generate trade ideas, gauge short interest sentiment, and evaluate your portfolio from a different angle. Find data faster, add depth to your trading analysis, and compare beyond plain numbers. Better research, better decisions. Visit IBKR.com. Interactive Brokers is a member SIPC.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Bang, zoom to the moon. Bitcoin ramps to new highs. Then again, so do equities. Goldilocks, yeah, she's back. And our guest today, my good friend Tom Nelson, SVP from Franklin Templeton Investments. All this and much more on episode number 862 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. There you have it, the best quarter for U.S. equities, the S&P 500 at least, since the first quarter of 2019. And that's saying something, I got to tell you, because, you know, it turns out when we look back and we think about what happened over the last 5 years, let's go 5 years, the pandemic turned out to be a pretty good thing financially. I mean, terrible from the aspect of disease and deaths and everything else. Societal, though, financial, I mean, it forced tech to advance. Money splashed on everyone. I guess it's probably the right phrase to say that we never let a good natural disaster go to waste, right? Governments will step in. They'll come in and they'll do what they can. And that supercharged all sorts of areas around the world. In particular, what it did, it created the necessity, it really necessitated the advancement of the web of technology for meetings. It really sparked the next generation of what we know now is smart computing or AI. And what we have today is really this compressed period of time that allowed for riches to be made, wealth to be earned. And on top of that, companies had the ability, the financial, the backing, the monies, the access at low rates to do things that maybe would have taken a generation to do in 4 or 5 years. Pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. Andrew Horowitz, that's me. I'm a little skeptical today. Yeah, okay. I'll give you that. And it was a very good quarter. It was an excellent quarter. I mean, from all aspects of what happened. For just about, I would say just about almost every asset class. Clearly, Bitcoin and crypto is on fire, right? That was just a great thing that seemed to never give in to anything ever since the ETFs were approved. And that came through the system and that was like, well, there we go. It's available and now everybody's just going to start buying. That little dip that we saw there, but then it came back and hit new highs again last week. Even with the U.S. dollar holding steady, rates higher. You know, we went from 7 to 3 to 1-ish. 7 to 3 to 1. What is that? We went from 7 rate cuts at the beginning of the year. That was the expectation by market participants. I mean, we saw the Fed Fund futures. They were at 7 cuts that they saw through 2024. I mean, that's a lot. And then all of a sudden, people started realizing, well, inflation is maybe not entirely dead. Maybe March is not going to be the time, which we know now, for the Fed to start cutting. Maybe the Fed's only going to do 3. They're only going to do 3 because, you know, there's some inflation, but, you know, that's transitory. We talked about that last week. And, you know, maybe it's going to come back to the trend being more disinflation. And we're going to see jobs and losses and problems in all areas of the economy. None of that has transpired. We know that. And what's happening now? Well, we went to 3. Maybe we'll start in June. And the last round of PPI, CPI, and even the PCE, it's starting to show that maybe with a 3.4 GDP, it's possible that we don't need to have these cuts. Maybe we're only down to 1, which is really interesting because the markets don't seem to care. This is still an incredible amount of excitement surrounding owning almost everything. And a couple of areas that we looked at didn't do as well for the quarter. I mean, you look at, for example, the primary one probably was the interest rate sensitive areas. Utilities, real estate, REITs, not so great. But commodities, I mean, look at oil, nearing another breakout point, hovering really close to 83 on all the things that are going on in the Middle East, as well as what we're seeing in Russia and what we're seeing about some demand issues and shutting down because the spreads that we're seeing on many of the refiners are starting to tighten up to a point that they need to shut down. They need to bring those spreads back to make it more profitable. And all of this is impacting oil in a very significant way. And we've also seen things like cocoa hit extreme levels and commodities in general, whether it's the ags, whether it's the foodstuffs again, whether it's the oils, gold, silver, and I don't know, we could throw in crypto into the commodity space to a degree. Well, they're all doing pretty well. So it just goes to show you that the markets and the economics that are behind all the things that we see, that we get all these reports in on a regular basis, don't always move in a rhythm. Now, eventually when you zoom out, they're synchronized. I'll give you that. And so if you're thinking, you know, why are the markets continuing to move up or stable, no matter what? A lot of people asking that. I think I've touched on this a couple of times. And I think you have to just accept sometimes that there's a confidence and crowdthink that takes over sometimes. And right now, what I feel, what I see, what I hear is that most investors, most people, the average Joe who is investing right now, they're not looking at today, tomorrow. They're not looking at next month. They're looking past it. They're looking at whatever's happening with the near-term issues. They're saying to themselves, okay, I get that, but what about what's going to happen in the future, 1, 5, 10 years from now, and how would it all pay off? Which is an interesting way to look at it, right? And I think other people are saying, you know, let me ask you a question, they're saying. What's the worst that can happen? I mean, a global pandemic, pandemic with a synchronized global shutdown of businesses and life as we know it? I mean, look how that turned out, right? Not so bad. I mean, terrible for when we went through it, but I'm talking about just the pure financial side. So let's strip that out for a second and just look at not the societal impact of it, but just the financial side. One thing we know for sure, it changed Eco 101 as we know it. It changed our relationship with money as we know it. In fact, it was a crash course and a compressed time frame on how to better invest for our futures. We had no choice. And the investors today, my clients, have a much better sense of patience and understanding of how the game is played. So that's a good thing. That's a really good thing. And looking ahead to quarter two, I mean, it's the near term. The question is, will we have that magical 5 to 10% pullback that everybody's been thinking about? You know, is it going to finally happen? I don't know. Everybody thinks it's going to happen. It probably won't. It's when everybody says, okay, forget it. It's just going to be all just peaches and cream that we see things. But I did hear something interesting this week. The S&P 500, the way it's constructed currently with the market cap weighting, has a PE, the forward PE of 21 to 22 or so, something like that. And when you look at the equal weighted S&P 500, we're talking about 14, 15 on a forward PE. So that's really kind of interesting. And when you think about, we know, oh, everybody's talking about, well, we're really in stretched zone for the S&P 500. The question then comes out, well, is it really that stretch? Is it really that expensive when you just lop off the top 10 stocks? And what may actually happen is a big catch-up trade. That could be next. Small caps, anything other than the top 10 biggies, or it can be the opposite as well. It may be a crater, or as I say sometimes, a sinkhole forming when some things are holding up the rest of the market. So right now, not much in the way that says we're any imminent danger. Sentiment is good. I mean, so there's that. Let's take a minute and talk about Interactive Brokers again, because I want you to discover the future of trading with IBKR Desktop. Interactive Brokers, next generation, their trading platform, which is built from the ground up. IBKR Desktop, it combines their powerful, really powerful features with a unique set of groundbreaking tools it's really streamlined. I guess that's the best way to describe it. It's a streamlined, it has an intuitive interface. And whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, Interactive Brokers Desktop, IBKR Desktop, redefines what you can expect from a trading platform. Experience the future of trading today. Download IBKR Desktop at ibkr.com/desktop. Now let's get to the next segment of this episode. And our guest today is Tom Nelson. He's the Senior Vice President and Head of Asset Allocation, Portfolio Management for Franklin Templeton Investment Solutions. He's a member of the Investment Strategy and Research Committee. And he's a portfolio manager of a number of the funds offered in various jurisdictions. He's lead portfolio manager of the Franklin Next Step Fund Series, the Franklin Vol Smart Allocation VIP Fund, numerous model portfolios. And also, he works in the area of the Life Smart Retirement Target Funds, which I want to talk to him about today. So lots going on in the area of asset allocation, et cetera. And I want to welcome you, Tom Nelson, back. How are you? It's been a bit of a time since we were on last. Hope everything is well.
I'm well, yeah. Thank you for having me back.
Good. Tom and I know each other from the club, by the way. We we partake and have some drinks and dinners here and there. And besides that, he is an excellent guest. Just want to tell you about it. He's a good guy, too.
Well, thank you, sir.
Yep. I don't know. Where do we want to start? Let's talk about asset allocation. Let's talk about the concept. I talk about this a lot with our listeners. And let me set the stage for you a little bit. We had a period that we talked about last time. I looked at the notes of what we talked about last time. Mm-hmm. And 2022, we knew was like, oh, my God, asset allocation is dead. It's dead. It's gone. It's over. Every single asset class was just like kerplunked. Bonds did things that bonds never did in like, I don't even know when. And the buffer that we had, the portfolio didn't buffer. Yeah. So that was 2022. We were asking the question in 2023 when we were last together, you know, is that? And we discussed the potential for 60-40, et cetera. So 2023, on the other hand, was a mirror effect, or let's call it the opposite, right? Everything was up. Everything was great. Where are we now in terms of the thought of, asset allocation as a tool for the, let's call it the modern investing era?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So 2022 calendar year was absolutely a really difficult year for asset allocation, right? This was the first year in 50 that you had stocks and bonds go down, produce negative total returns together. And that obviously was a black eye for those types of portfolios. Hindsight is always 20/20, and I think, you know, if you look back, there were a few things that might have been signals that we were due for some sort of a year like that. But just since that last discussion that we had here, which was in May of last year, I think, since then, so it's going on a year's time, our flagship 60/40 global portfolio is up 20% through yesterday, right? Yeah, and so maybe the rumors of that 60/40 demise are greatly exaggerated. And, you know, I can talk a little bit about the strategies that we run, but the Franklin Moderate Allocation Fund, that's our 60/40 portfolio in our target risk suite that was launched back in 1996, so call it 28 years ago. In that 28-year period, it's delivered 90% of the return to stocks with 65% of the risk, right? So most of the return with about a third less risk. If you look at rolling five-year returns at the end of each month since inception back in 96, there have been zero periods of negative returns while stocks have had negative returns 20% of the time. And if you look at any rolling 12-month period, or with a one-year look back, when stocks are down, 93% of the time, the fund has outperformed stocks with an average outperformance of 7.6% when stocks are down.
That's the buffer component, though.
That's the buffer component, right. Yeah. So, you know, these are stats on one of the funds that I manage, but that story is similar for any well-managed asset allocation portfolio with a moderate level of risk, right? Keeps you well-diversified through all market environments. Helps when markets are down. By the way, we've outperformed bonds 86% of the time when bonds are down in any 12-month period, with an average outperformance of about 9.5% in those periods. And so that stability and diversification, I think, helps you sleep well at night. And the outlook today, we have yields on fixed income where you're actually getting yield in fixed income for the first time, you know, in over a decade. Stocks are maybe getting a little bit expensive, but the overall outlook for, call it, the next 6 to 12 months and the next 10 years or so is still, I think, unchanged versus kind of the long-term expectations for portfolios like those.
So let's just go back to the 60/40 concept. You mentioned that that's moderate. Is that always been moderate? Has 60/40 been the moderate investor? What does that even mean?
Yeah, that generally gives you a level of risk. And what that means is, you know, 60% equities, 40% fixed income on balance. We're a global firm and a global team. So most of our portfolios are globally oriented, but whether or not that's global equities and global bonds or US equities and US bonds, if you were to compare a portfolio that is comprised of 60% stocks, 40% bonds, you tend to get about a third less risk than you do in stocks, right? The conservative portfolio is usually somewhere in the vicinity of 30 to 40% stocks, and the more aggressive type of portfolio, still with kind of an asset allocation tilt, is somewhere around 80% overall. Mm-hmm. The bulk of the risk is going to be driven by equities because they're that much riskier than stocks, but it provides you that ballast that gives you a little bit of asymmetry, right? A little bit more of the upside when things are good and a little bit less of the downside when things are bad.
Right. Now, one of the things that I just want to get back to diversification as a key term for a minute, mm-hmm. is that, you know, the idea of diversification, a lot of people think it's just, it means a lot of stuff, right? I mean, that's literally the definition that they use. It's like, look at all the stuff I have. It's like, wait, let me look. What do we got? Okay, you got Microsoft, you got NVIDIA. That's great. Awesome. They're doing, you know, really well. Or, you know, 10 different healthcare stocks that are basically in the same area. And they may do very well. But, you know, one of the things that I've looked at over the years and something to try to discover, particularly when it comes to ETFs, mutual funds, mm-hmm. A little bit easier to do with individual stocks, is this overlap risk. I don't know if we've talked about that on the show before, but the idea of, you know, okay, you have great. You have, you know, 12 different funds. They all do the same darn thing, right? They're all closet S&Ps. You know, what about that? Is that an issue for investors?
It can be. And we obviously want to avoid diversification, rather than diversification, right? Yeah. So too many things together can ultimately, you know, too much of a good thing can ultimately be a bad thing. But we spend a lot of time looking at various scenarios and ensuring that, one, our portfolios are aligned with what we think is the most likely scenarios, right? Of economic growth, of what the Federal Reserve does, of geopolitical risks, although those are super difficult to model against. But you kind of want to be prepared for everything. We steer clear of the term all weather because—
Oh, the old world weather.
Right?
Oh, the old world weather portfolio. I remember that. That was the day. Yeah. That came out with the Days of the Mountain charts from American funds.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, that's really hard to produce positive returns regardless of what happens in 2022 is a perfect example of that. But you want to be prepared for a little bit of everything, right? And so looking at various scenarios, both best case and worst case and base case— trying to make sure that the portfolio endures through those different types of scenarios. And so that could be another spike in inflation. You know, what does that do to the portfolio? That could be a shock to economic growth, which would be certainly a negative for stocks. How does that, you know, how does that impact the portfolio? And so getting exposure to a number of different strategies under the hood of the portfolio that, one, we think work very well in isolation, and two, work very well together in an overall portfolio construct such that you don't have too much of everything, right? You don't need a bunch of portfolios that all own a bunch of Apple and Microsoft and have, you know, too much technology exposure. And so one of the things that we will look at both from an asset allocation perspective is, you know, how much we have in stocks and bonds and how much we have in US versus non-US, but also factors. And those factors can be growth versus value versus momentum. And those can also be various risk factors. You know, what's our exposure to inflation? What's our exposure to different commodities, et cetera? And that is something that's something a little bit more detailed that we get into with our risk management team and some of the analysts that work for us. But all those things are considerations because at the end of the day, we want portfolios that can be fairly stable and people can sleep well at night with.
You know, you talk about factors and there's a variety of guests that I've had on recently. We talk about, you know, the idea of factors. Meb Faber, a good friend of mine, he's on. We talk about factors. Last week, Paul Merriman, we talked about the factor of small cap value. You know, he was pounding the table. I mean, sledgehammering the table. Mm-hmm. That small cap value, if there's any one particular sector or factor that can be mm-hmm. utilized to give the best diversification against large cap stocks, the usual portfolio, the S&P 500 is just by a portion of the portfolio in small cap value. Which yep. I thought was pretty fascinating.
Yeah. Small caps and value are two factors that have certainly lagged and could be well poised to outperform on a go-forward basis. So maybe unpacking each of them individually. On small caps, we're, I would say, cautiously optimistic, right? The growth backdrop is pretty good. So growth is generally getting better. I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about kind of the macroeconomic environment. Mm-hmm. And with growth getting better, that's a positive for small caps. I would point out two areas of concern, but we do have a modestly positive view on small caps. First, there are more companies today in the Russell 2000 index, and that's kind of the benchmark index for small cap stocks. More companies today in the Russell 2000 that are ever before. That's not good.
You cut out. I think you meant unprofitable. Yeah.
Yeah. Unprofitable. Yeah. And two, a simple heuristic on kind of switching between small caps and large caps historically is based upon the yield spread of high yield bonds relative to treasuries. High yield companies have a large amount of overlap with small caps in terms of kind of the companies in the index and the characteristics of those companies. The general rule of thumb is that you want to buy small caps when the spread of high yield over treasuries is 6% or greater, right? And that's kind of when pessimism reigns, that's when oftentimes it is really good to buy into small caps. And you want to sell small caps when high yield spreads are below 3%. That spread closed yesterday at 3.01%. Mm. And we've been having a lot of conversations around just some of the froth in the high yield bond market and its relation to small caps that might be a negative there. So, but we're, you know, like I said, modestly positive on small caps from a macro perspective, but we do have some concerns. On value, the growth acceleration, economic and earnings growth acceleration is good for value versus growth, but the market feels a bit more late cycle, which would be an environment where growth outperforms.
Which is what's been happening.
Yeah. And with short-term interest rates set to fall in 2024, that would be a tailwind for growth over value as well. Now, on the flip side of that, as equity market breadth broadens out, you've got over 80% of the stocks in the S&P 500 that trade above their 50-day moving average, and another 80% plus that trade above their 200-day moving averages. That breadth is poised to help, at the very least, value narrow its performance deficit to growth. So kind of, if you bring those two together, small cap value is very well poised, particularly from a valuation perspective, which is much better, and this gets you to your time horizon kind of conversation, a much better timing indicator for long periods of time, kind of 5 to 10 years. So if you want to set it and forget it over the next 5 to 10 years, absolutely, that is one of the best places to be. Over the next kind of 6 to 12 months, maybe a little bit less so. And we kind of come out somewhere in the middle.
Let me two things. First of all, you said that interest rates are set to fall in 2024-5, right? That's your commentary. I'm going to go against that. I'm going to push against it. I've been pushing against that since last year, by the way, since the 7-3-1, mm-hmm. right? I'm not exactly sure how we maintain a high level of overall growth, you know, GDP over 3% and, you know, employment at, let's say, sub 4% or right at 4% unemployment. Yeah. And all the other things and earnings and everything that's going on. And then at the same time, expect the Fed to knock down rates. I get it. It's just hard to imagine. And furthermore, one other thing, mm-hmm. if they do knock down rates, I don't know necessarily that's going to actually knock down rates. Does that make sense? We're pretty much priced into what we think is going to be. I don't know. Just seems to me to be far-fetched and market narrative of hoping and, you know, and by the way, living, I just talked about this in the opening, mm-hmm. where the market narrative that has been brought forth, the first thing that really telegraphed back in October of last year that, you know, hey, good news, there's bad news, right? So let's buy. And then that turned into, okay, well, that's not happening. What else can we grab onto? Oh, I got it. AI. So that's the new thing. I don't know, just something to think about. But if we continue to see what's happening, which is, again, I talked about this on the opening, and I'll just share this with you. Something about, I heard something last week about the S&P 500 is approximately, give or take, 22 forward PE, which is mm-hmm. historically high. However, but if you extract out the main ones by doing an equal weighted, you know, the big boys do an equal mm-hmm. weighted S&P, it's like 14, 15, which is not too terrible. No. So if we continue to see this passive investing, which people just mechanically and nothing wrong with this, mechanically mm-hmm. putting money into work through pension plans and just, you know, the SPY, the QQQs, whatever it is that are top heavy. You know, we're going to see this continue on, and is there any chance for active to really shine here, or passive going to be doing its thing, or factors, or what?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I do think that the amount of money that has moved into passive has made it difficult to outperform your capital weighted indices like the S&P 500, and the S&P equal weighted index is one that has underperformed the cap weighted S&P. I think the other portion of that is, you know, the Magnificent Seven, right? So those companies that are the largest in market cap today are companies that have really strong earnings. So, you know, much stronger growth than what you see in the market overall, you know, 2x or more and way more in a couple of cases. And so, you know, there's U.S. exceptionalism, and then there's exceptionalism within the U.S., which has made those cap weighted indices so top heavy, and it's been really difficult. And just to think about, you know, large cap growth stocks, so the Russell 1000 index, the Russell 1000 growth index, those Magnificent Seven stocks today represent about 45% of that index. And that makes it really difficult for active managers to take full positions, much less be overweight, and still maintain appropriate levels of diversification based upon their regulatory mutual fund diversification rules that make it really difficult for managers to get full positions in these seven stocks. And so in some cases, why fight that headwind? And instead, it is easy to get passive large cap growth exposure through ETFs. Mm-hmm. Without the same diversification limitations, right? And so we're active managers. We will use passive products to help facilitate that active management. You mentioned factors. We like the quality factor, and that's one that tilts towards companies with steady and predictable profitability and with low levels of debt on their balance sheets. And by the way, there's a lot of overlap with some of those Magnificent Seven stocks. And, you know, it's kind of a stable way to play the growth factor these days. And so we'll own passive exposure via ETFs for pure quality exposure in portfolios. And should our views change, we can easily liquidate that position and move it elsewhere.
You know, but it's interesting, you know, you have a certain set of rules and people that you have to satisfy. Mm-hmm. You have these benchmarks that you need to hit. You know, you have these guys that are going out selling your products. Let's be honest, right? That need to have the numbers on a piece of paper that back up all of this. I get that. You need to have it for the pension plans. I understand all of that. You can't. Nobody's going to say, well, you know, we're sticking by our plan because we think this in 2 years, and we're willing to underperform for a couple of years, and that doesn't happen in your world, right? It's just not a plan mm-hmm. that you want to live with. So my question is, though, let's get down to the reality of it, the behind the scenes. In your meetings, when you're talking with your other cohorts, managers, you know, all the people that you're working with, and you said mm-hmm. something that, you know, we are moderately positive on something. I don't know if that means that like three people in the room like it, two people in the room don't like it, one person hates it, one person loves it. You know, I'm not sure mm-hmm. what that means. But when you look at some of the large cap stocks, we all know that there's a limitation on how many boards and chips NVIDIA can actually, even if they're the only firm, even forget about anybody else, no competition. Yep. There's a limitation of the actual long-term need of their boards mm-hmm. in a certain period of time. Does it get you a little nervous, some of the things that are going on right now? Not only with them, but with other companies?
Yeah. And look, we like stocks today over bonds. We like U.S. over the rest of the world. And there are some signs that give us a little bit of pause kind of on a near-term basis. And so when we think of the world, we'll think first of growth and leading indicators of growth and where they are, because they're really important. And you can tie out where we are within kind of the growth cycle. Are things good? Are they getting bad? Are they good? Are they bad? Are they getting better? Are they getting worse? And you've got really good dispersion of returns to stocks based upon kind of those four quadrants, right? And so growth is pretty good, and it's actually getting a little bit better. We saw some revisions of GDP this morning. We saw some consumer numbers come in strong. So the economy continues to be resilient. and the consumer continues to be resilient, right? Inflation is getting better, but it's still a little bit sticky. Policy, we think the Fed is likely to reduce rates a little bit. I might take the under on three rate cuts this year. But then there's things like positioning and sentiment, which is a little bit more fast twitch. And things have really gotten stretched from a sentiment and positioning standpoint. And here are a couple of examples. A number of the sentiment indicators that we track are in a state of excessive optimism, which, using history as a guide, is not a great environment for stocks. The S&P 500 index is up 28% since the lows in October. From a long-term technical perspective, stocks are as overbought as they've been in 6 years, according to some metrics, mm-hmm. and as overbought as they've been in over 20 years, according to others. Positioning across cohorts of investors such as hedge funds and risk parity funds is very bullish, like top few percentiles versus history bullish, and so not much more room to move there. Companies, corporates, they've been buying back stock. We've seen estimates of about $1 trillion that companies are putting to work buying back their own stock expected for 2024. They've been a huge buyer of stocks over the last couple of years. They're currently in, there are blackout periods around kind of end of quarters and as you get into earnings season where companies are not allowed to buy back their stock. And so they're in kind of a blackout period right now. And so since trees don't necessarily grow to the sky, we feel that stocks are a little bit vulnerable here. And we would probably be buyers of equities to get a little bit more overweight on a pullback of maybe 5% or so from current levels, which we would deem to really be healthy. And so to see some consolidation, to see a little bit of a pullback, wouldn't be surprising, and we think long term would actually be, you know, good for the health of the market.
You would think that there's going to be, I mean, the 5 to 10% pullback that everybody's been looking for, just as a normal 5 to 10% pullback. You know, mm-hmm. it's almost like when small caps are up, they take down the large caps. You know, you've seen this rotation going on.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's a really weird and very well planned and very computer driven, as I see it, mm-hmm. button push of You know what? They're taking down Apple. You know, let's push up NVIDIA because then we can keep the queues up. Mm-hmm. You know, they're taking down, you know, small caps. Well, we'll ramp into this. And it just keeps the markets in a stasis mode, which is kind of pretty interesting. So with regard to higher rates that we have right now, right, that are in place right now, it seems like valuations haven't really budged because even if we look at the S&P 500 from a normal standpoint, right, with the 22 forward or the equal weight mm-hmm. with a 14, 15 or so, it doesn't look like the interest rates that we all looked at to put in into your models to discount based on a risk-free rate of return now from 2% went to 5%. It doesn't seem like anything changed.
No. And look, I mean, the outlook I think has been generally pretty good. You would have expected with higher interest rates that we've seen over the last, call it, you know, 12 to 18 months or so, that would have been a headwind to equities overall, right? Higher borrowing costs, yeah. Higher costs of capital and cost of funding and things along those lines, particularly, quote unquote, longer duration assets like technology names. Now, what we've witnessed is a further kind of bifurcation of the market in the haves and the have-nots, right? Unprofitable tech has massively underperformed the profitable tech companies. And to use that Magnificent Seven analogy once again, and there's more beyond those, but the bigger, profitable, strong cash, they've kind of been impervious to higher levels of interest rates. And so it's the companies that have been the exceptional producers of cash flows and earnings and revenues, steady and consistent, that which is another reason why we like, you know, kind of that quality factor over time, slow and steady, or in some cases fast and steady, tends to really win the race. And so as much as we talk about, you know, tech names, there is a big difference between the haves and the have-nots, even within the technology sector.
Yeah. I want to switch gears. I want to talk about the target date funds, because I think that people know what they don't know. A lot of people don't know. The average person that doesn't have a pension plan, 401k plan, may not have any idea what this is, right?
Yeah.
They know what asset allocation funds are, and they may not know what exactly target date funds are, which, by the way, if I may just for a second state my own opinion about what it is, it's an asset allocation fund that automatically asset allocates according to your age and risk factors over time. Would that be something that you could agree with?
Yes, agree. Yeah.
So there's also the ones I like to use it for, besides some people that are indecisive with regard to their 401ks, et cetera, because it's a great thing. It's like, well, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to do it. Do yourself a favor. What? How old are you? Okay, you're 50 years old. You're going to retire in 15 years. Get the target date 2039 fund, whatever the exact number is. And essentially what's happening is it's maybe, I'm going to make this up, 60-40 stocks right now, but it's going to slowly over time go from 60-40, then 55-45, and 50-40, till the date that it becomes the zero date is 100% in cash or bonds, but use cash, right? So where I really like this for is, yes, 401ks, but 529 plans. I think this is a great way to deal with, you know, the automation of a 529 plan. Thoughts on that?
Yeah. So specifically 529s or?
I just think it's, you could talk about it in general, but 529s, yeah. I think it's a natural fit.
Yeah. For both of them, just the simplicity, the set it and forget it, and keeping you in the market was really important, right? So there are studies that show missing the 10 biggest days in the market over the last 20 years has led to approximately half the total return than simply staying invested and not missing those days, right? Which is, it's really difficult to near impossible to predict when those things are going to occur. So it keeps people from getting nervous, getting scared, moving out of the market, potentially missing, you know, big days and big trading days. So you stay in the market, you stay well diversified, you stay at a level of risk that's appropriate for someone at all times. And the set it and forget it really does help. Now, 529s are a similar type of portfolio, and those are a great way to set it and forget it. But instead of tax advantaged retirement savings, 529s help investors to save for higher education needs, right? Those contributions, they're tax-free. The withdrawals are tax-free, so long as they're for higher education purposes. And that's recently been expanded to include K through 12 and student loan payments. And another recent beneficial change, as of January 1st of this year, owners of 529 accounts, they can make tax-free and penalty-free rollovers into Roth IRA accounts. So if families are fortunate enough to have the 529s fund their children's education and have some money left in those accounts at the end, they can roll that money into a Roth IRA without taxes or without penalties and use it as a head start on retirement savings.
Yeah, I think there's some rules on that, like a minimum of 15 years invested, a few other things. Yeah. But you opened up the can on something, and you mentioned with regard to the top 10 days. Mm-hmm. Where is the study that shows missing the top 10 days and the bottom worst 10 days? How come we never hear that?
I have that. I would have to pull it out and show you those
results. Saying,
there is data.
Like it should be the fairest thing to look at. I think it still benefits the fact of buy and hold, by the way, just as a punchline, because I've seen it, I've done it. But the fact is that it always seems to me like it's so one-sided. I mean, if we're going to pull out the best days, we should pull out the worst days.
Well, just for the narrative when you're trying to tell people to stay in the market.
Well, it doesn't fit the narrative, of course. That's a good point. So the one of the things that I've noticed over the years that the target date funds became more comprehensive. And for example, there was simple in especially in 529s. There was paths, right? These, you know, various years you could pick.
Yeah.
But then you could pick. So for example, if I picked, I'm just gonna pick a year in the future, 2050 as a mm-hmm. year. Okay. 2050 and well, which I don't think you'd have a 529 for 2050 because somebody had to be really old for that. But whatever the year is, you know, now plus 20 years. And but then they'd have a conservative track, a moderate track, and an aggressive track within those years, correct, which is kind of interesting.
Yes.
So how does that work?
And one of the 529 plans for one of the states that we manage does have those three levels of risk tolerance for each age band or the year of matriculation when you expect your children to need the funding. And the premise behind that is either some people can afford to take more or less risk, and some people may have a preference for more or less risk. I sometimes, when talking about these things, use the example of my wife and two of her friends, and they go into a casino and they have, you know, very similar a dollar amount in, you know, in their purse that they can gamble with, but they will spend it and they will use it completely differently. And so, you know, different people have different attitudes towards risk and comfort with taking risk.
Right.
And it just offers more choice. By and large, what you generally tend to see in those scenarios is kind of the middle of the road, moderate strategy, particularly when people aren't necessarily certain. That's going to be their default choice.
Yeah. Let's talk about, I think it's mandatory that we segue into a discussion of model portfolios and the way that things have moved over the years from the industry that was commission-based brokerage to mm-hmm. fee-based advisory, and how different it is today from your perspective as the fund managers. And I think it was last week. You've been doing this a long time. I wonder if you remember this. But last week with Paul Merriman, I was talking about, do you remember the Fidelity program trades, program mutual fund that you paid like an upfront cost and you were stuck in it for like 8 years? Do you remember these?
I don't.
It was a very expensive proposition. It was a contract that you signed with Fidelity and you put your money in and you could not, like literally couldn't get it out.
Right.
There was no liquidity on it at all. And it was this weird, like, the costs were just, they finally like banned them. They're like, done. That's not going to happen. Yeah. But similarly, maybe not to the same extent, there's been a big change. I mean, are B shares still a big thing?
No.
C shares? No. That's probably a bigger.
I don't see much in the way of C share business.
So what are you seeing? You're seeing A's and what do you, so just to clarify, for the audience that has no idea what I'm talking about here. Mutual funds have different ways of compensating the brokers that sell them. I'm not talking about the no load, no fees, institutional. Forget that. Those there's no fees. But there's no fees to compensate. But the old line mutual funds, when you bought an A fund, you may have paid 5.5%, what it was called initial load to get into. Now, if you did above 100,000, maybe it was knocked down to 3.5%. B shares, you didn't pay anything, but there was a contingent deferred sales charge that you paid over a period of, let's say, 3 years potentially, right? That if you got out, you pay maybe, I don't know, 3% of whatever the value was if you sold it with it the first year, 2%, then 1%, then nothing. C shares were kind of this like, they'll clip you a little bit on the front, they'll clip you a little bit on the back, and that was like this way of doing things. Then you had other ways also. So anyway, there's all these different ways of having a compensation package for the advisor, broker, stock guy, dude, right, gal, whatever. Okay, with all that as a backdrop, what are you seeing these days?
Yeah, so we're seeing a major move from brokerage accounts where these types of share classes are utilized to kind of fee-based advisory, where investors will typically pay their advisor a flat annual fee on their accounts. The types of share classes of funds that that advisors will purchase has changed, and they tend to be kind of a flat fee per annum, for a flat management fee, without either upfront charges or ladder charges. And also within that, with that shift in account type, has been kind of a focus on maybe efficiency and economies of scale, for lack of a better term, whereby the portfolio management component, that's asset allocation, strategy selection, portfolio construction, risk management, is now oftentimes being outsourced to both an internal centralized investment team, like a CIO office at like a big wirehouse or brokerage firm. Mm-hmm. And then also to asset managers like Franklin Templeton, who have dedicated teams like the one that I lead, to focus on managing those portfolios. And what that allows the advisors to do is be more efficient and focus on and outsource that portfolio management capability, and focus on other value-added aspects of building and managing their practices. And so we're seeing business opportunities in managing model portfolios, some of which will be invested in Franklin Templeton internal proprietary strategies, and some of them will be in third-party strategies where we'll own mutual funds and ETFs by a number of our competitors. But at the end of the day, trying to build a portfolio that's appropriate for various levels of risk tolerance, and in some cases, you know, different outcomes that that kind of the home office of that firm has asked us to build. But the growth has really been strong over the last 5 years or so. We're seeing greater adoption at firms like these, more advisors using them. And what started with the traditionally a set of models with different levels of risk tolerance, it's expanded to include things like alternative investments, specific objectives like income generation, for example.
That's good stuff. I mean, do you know I've been fighting for this since 1990? We went fee-based in 1990. That was when everybody's like, huh, what are you talking about? You know, everybody was still doing all their fee, you know, commission-based stuff, and, you know, selling all sorts of things to the client for the purpose of, you know, making money for themselves. And we're like, no, it seems better. And to be honest with you, and to be very upfront, it was, at the time, it was a big sacrifice because, you know, you're going through from, you know, getting paid 4% and 5% on every deposit somebody makes to, you know, I don't know, 1%, 1.5% or whatever it is. So now all of a sudden there's a whole change in the dynamic of your financials. And we said, to hell with it. It doesn't matter. This is so much better for the client and the relationship that we have with them, that this is a lot, you know, a lot better to work with. The thing that we're talking about these days is, okay, well, where does this go? So you're talking about, I think it's called TAMP. Isn't it called TAMP? TAM? TAMP?
There's I'm trying to remember exactly what that stands for, but yes.
It's TAMP and like Orion. They have these plugins that, or these different companies that say, you know, we could pick and say, okay, just run the portfolio with that advisor, with that strategy, and it just runs. And the question I have for you, and maybe this is something that's been hair-raising with your team a little bit, is the concern about, you know, where are we going with regard to AI? Is that going to be something that is, you know, I don't know what that means, the consumer-generated, consumer-assisted, computer-assisted? You know, is AI something that's like, oh boy, we need to get into this and commoditize this whole thing, lower costs, and because somebody's going to do it anyway?
So AI has been really hot, right? And our team actually put out a thought leadership piece a few months ago. You can find it on our website. And the title is Co-pilot, Not Autopilot. How Generative AI Augments But Doesn't Replace Active Management. And that's really how we think about it, right? As a tool to help us make investment decisions. And maybe I'll note three kind of relevant applications from that paper, specifically as it pertains to managing portfolios, right? Large language models, LLMs, are just feed into some sort of an AI tool. And we use them to help combine the sentiment expressed via like unstructured information. That's things like tweets, analyst reports, news stories, et cetera. And we combine that with structured data that we've traditionally used, things like earnings releases, macroeconomic indicators, to identify potential incongruities that might lead to a change in sentiment before it shows up in those company earnings reports or macroeconomic indicators. So it's taking a whole bunch of data and trying to provide a little bit of sentiment, i.e., okay, GDP was revised higher for the fourth quarter, but are there things that are coming out in tweets and in news that might tell us a little bit something differently? Mm-hmm. AI can, and this is really cool, we're starting to analyze the trades made in our portfolios and help to point out if any behavioral biases exist, right? So for example, there's this disposition effect, right? Which basically means that some investors are reluctant to selling their losers, but they're happy to shed assets that have had, you know, decent sized price increases. And to be able to kind of differentiate between what's a smart investment decision supported by valuations and one that's driven by emotions, like, you know, the avoidance of regret of selling a loser, is where we can train AI on the previous trades that we've done in portfolios and combine that with kind of behavioral finance and take the role of an unbiased coach to help us make more rational investment decisions mm-hmm. going forward. Mm-hmm. And then the third, this one's a bit further out in the future, but it is something that we're actually working on. We've got a tech team within our Franklin Templeton Investment Solutions Group, works on a lot of technology platform stuff for us. They're working on something that's leveraging AI, kind of a conversational query to be able to run portfolio optimization. So ultimately, we'd like to be able to ask an AI co-pilot to construct a portfolio that's resilient to Federal Reserve interest rate cuts, could still offer a 4% yield, is not overweight the growth factor, and would have an annualized risk of less than 12% over the last 5 years, and actually get a model back. That gets you a little bit closer to autopilot than co-pilot, but you know, our interaction with optimizers and what we think is best practice for managing multi-asset portfolios is that they can be a tool to help inform us on portfolio recommendations and marry kind of the quantitative with the fundamental, but not to replace the portfolio management function overall. And AI, we think, is, you know, is a tool that can help us be more efficient and do a better job of managing portfolios, but it is not kind of the robots taking over the world.
I mean, you look at like the calculations that needed to be done with the Harry Markowitz, Efficient Frontier, Farmer French, and even yeah. looking at, you know, the you know, Sharp, William Sharp kind of portfolio construction, right? Utilizing spreadsheets and students, by the way, to do the calculation versus modern day where you could do this on the fly. I mean, how fast can you do an efficient frontier, downside risk calculation, standard deviation today versus it was, let's say, even 20 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, it's a much different situation. So those things I totally get. And I think that will probably bring us a lot more potential to bring in asset class like alternatives, right? Yep. How do they really react? We know intuitively how these things work, and we know from a standpoint of correlation that they're not highly correlated, and we look at downside deviation and what the portfolio does in those, using those as some kind of diversifier buffers, but how much really do we want in there, right, in some of this? So that's good stuff. A tool. Yeah. I think the tool is the key word there on all that. So it's great. We're going to wrap it, Tom Nelson with Franklin Templeton. Always always a pleasure, always good information, and I appreciate it. And we'll get this up and put some links to how to check out all the stuff over at Franklin Templeton. So thanks so much for all your insights.
Awesome. Thank you, Andrew.
All right, thanks. Okay. And that's going to wrap up another episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Another great guest. I got to tell you, we're on a roll this year. We got so many more lined up coming up. David Gaffin's coming up. Robbie Mills coming up. Steve Senelgut is coming up. What else we got coming up? John Williams. We got Frank Curzio. That's mid-May. We're booked all the way out into, it looks like, June. It's going to be a great number months ahead for the Disciplined Investor podcast. So make sure to keep your dial tuned in, as they say, and make sure to keep subscribed. Thank you for all the comments and, of course, the reviews. Tell your friends, tell your family. Lots more to come in the months ahead, weeks ahead, days ahead. Thanks so much. See you soon. Discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.